Thank you. I've titled this paper Wilhelm Röpke and the Restoration of Property. In a discussion with another famous conservative, Richard Weaver objected to the view that the solution of our problems lies in following in the footsteps of our ancestors. He said this wasn't enough, because we must ask which ancestors. After all, some were wise and some were foolish. In a similar manner, we may ask, is it enough to say that you are in favor of a free market economy? And like Weaver, we can respond by asking, which free market economy? Some forms are better than others. Röpke believed the best defense of a market economy was to distinguish its basic principles from the historical form the industrialized capitalistic economy actually took. By observing this distinction, Röpke was able to defend the ideal of a free market and a humane market economy without becoming trapped into defending those distortions many critics of capitalism have rightly identified. However, the difficulty in understanding Röpke for those of us on the political right is that we often find it difficult to make the distinction he made. We are perhaps unused to it. We live in a world restricted by two choices, so that we see our options as being either a welfare state model on your road to communism or some form of laissez-faireism. Which brings me back to my first question. Which free market economy should we be advocating? Röpke saw that our choices could be divided into two basic models of market economy. One is called the proletarianized market economy, and the second could be called the propertied market economy. Röpke argued strenuously all his life for the latter and not for the former. What is a proletarianized market economy? Somehow I don't feel the mic's on. Shall we try it now? Shall I go testing 1, 2, 3 as if I'm some professional announcer? Okay, are we all right? Okay, thank you. What is a proletarianized market economy? It is a deformity inherited from previous historical periods, as well as from certain imminent tendencies in modern economies. Röpke was particularly critical of what he called historically received capitalism. Sometimes he called it historically received liberalism, because it contained a number of such inherited abuses and distortions from the past, which left an excessive concentration of wealth in the hands of a few and left most people with little or no productive property of their own, and therefore dependent solely on their wages and their salaries, the fluctuations in the market, and those who, because of their wealth, could exert disproportionate influence on the direction of policy as well as the direction of the economy. These dependent people are proletarians because they have only their labor to sell. When proletarianized, people tend to seek relief in times of economic trouble through the expansion of government welfare benefits. And so in Röpke's vision, growth of the proletarian market economy and growth of modern governments are linked. To accept these deformities and tendencies complacently, however, would merely add fuel to the fires of the critics of capitalism and the promoters of collectivism. So some vigorous alternative is needed, though it cannot be either a form of collectivism or laissez-faireism in Röpke's view. What then is left to us? Part of the answer which Röpke subscribed to is to follow the German ordo-liberal school of economic thought. It is liberal in the sense that it believes in the efficacy of the market economy in providing material well-being and freedom, but it is ordo, or sometimes it's called neoliberal, in the belief that a source of order is needed in the economy that originates outside the economy, so that there is room for a positive or constructive economic policy that gives some direction to the market economy, consistent with its nature and other social goals. This is why ordo-liberals came to be identified with this social market economy in Germany, and it explains why Röpke's book, A Humane Economy, is subtitled The Social Framework of the Free Market. A free market economy does not produce the framework upon which it rests. There are both moral and material prerequisites to such an economy if it is to serve its purposes well. And that is, in part, a matter of public policy. But Rupka went beyond his ordo-liberal colleagues in specifying the fundamentals that provide the social part of the market system without becoming socialistic. Instead, he became humanistic or humane. Steeped as he was in the oldest traditions of the West, in the humanistic Erasmian school of education, which included both Christian and pre-Christian learning, Rupka not surprisingly brought this perspective to bear on his economic thinking, so that we, if we can categorize him at all, we have to simply call him a humane economist, or say that he belongs to a humanistic school of economic thought, as much or more so than to the ordo-liberal school. We see this in many ways, but not the least of which is his plan for the restoration of property, the economic cornerstone of his vision of a humane economy. He gives three desiderata for this restoration: education, decentralization, and personalization. Let me briefly go over these. Number one, education. The importance of the propertied free market over a proletarianized market is in the ownership of one's own productive property. As he says in his book, Moral Foundations, as distinct from the income which everybody wants as a matter of course, property requires a certain exertion on the part of the will and a particular attitude of mind, things which are anything but matters of course. Unfortunately, our present market system, he goes on to analyze, has suffered for the past century and a half from various degrees of proletarianization and dependency on money income. So much so that the desire for property itself has been weakened, like a sick person who no longer has the desire to get well. So we have a vast educational task, he says, to reawaken the desire for property. To possess and to hold does not begin with a promise, but with a demand, a moral appeal, because it requires, in his words, frugality, the capacity to weigh up the present and the future, a sense of continuity and preservation, the will to independence, and an outstanding family feeling. Perhaps most striking in this passage is his phrase, the will to independence. Freedom, as the German poet and philosopher Goethe said, has to be won anew every day. Property is the concrete expression of that economic freedom, which must also be won anew each day by an exercise of the will to stand on your own, the will to help others do so, so that they don't have to depend on government either. Property, not income, reawakens, reflects, and reinforces that will to independence that is essential to political as well as economic freedom. The second point is decentralization. The restoration of property requires that it be widely distributed. That means the concentrations of property inherited from the past or current plutocratic sources must be opposed. Small property holdings must be the goal of a humane policy. Otherwise, as Rupke said, concentration of property, which usually implies concentration of the means of production, is in effect the negation of property in its anthropological and social sense. Concentrated forms of property ownership may have their economic uses, but they are hurtful to property understood as something fulfilling human nature broadly and deeply. Decentralization, however, is simply another way of requiring the establishment of a broad middle class. Again, in Repke's words, progressive concentration destroys the middle class properly so-called, that is, an independent class possessed of small or moderate property and income, and instead gives the steady increase in the number of those who are not independent, the wage and salary earners, whose economic focus is not property, but money income. Today, we're still faced with problems of concentration in the existence and effects of large corporations, rootless enterprises, and generally what Repke called the cult of the colossal, or what we might today dub the depersonalized visit our website economy. Which brings me to the third criterion, personalization. The property Röpke has in mind must be personal, where the owner and the thing owned acquire an identity, not abstract and anonymous shares in the stock market. Röpke wants property that will give existence, in his words, stability, solidity, and roots, and possess some form of vital significance, by which he means something decisively affecting man's deepest sense of happiness and fulfillment as a human being. This is needed to regenerate man's personality that has been fragmented, again quoting him, by growing mechanization, specialization, and functionalization, which decompose the unity of human personality. In other words, in this context, Röpke means a form of property that is productive and can provide a home rooted in family, community, and tradition. So we have these three needs: education, decentralization, and personalization, the three chief features to restore property. But which form of property best meets these three needs? While Röpke was fighting in the trenches in France, a member of the German Reichstag, Regierungsrat Ritter, on the September 15th, 1918, the war is coming to a close and many workers are striking, and yet still many believe the war can be won for Germany. And so Regierungsrat Ritter is meeting with the striking workers, and he's negotiating with them, and he's trying to analyze in part what's gone wrong. And one of the things he says is that the problems of the time are, at least in part, in his words, due to the fact that the workmen spent all their pay on drink before the war, and that if they had saved, everyone would have his little house and garden and be independent. Now, regardless of the application of this formula to this particular set of circumstances, it's the formula itself that I draw your attention to. The house and the garden as a formula equals some measure of economic independence. Later on, this would be Röpke's formula. As I bring this further to a close, let me give you a somewhat lengthy quote so that you get the full flavor as Röpke unwinds a bit on what this means. Land. This form of property possesses the still further characteristic that it can also embrace the home. It is that form of property which, in this double capacity, can make an end of proletarianization. The industrial worker can and ought to become, at least, the proprietor of his own residence and garden, which would provide him with produce from the land. This would also render him finally independent of the tricks of the market with its wage and price complexities and its business fluctuations. On the one hand, we ought to maintain in being and increase to the utmost of our power all who are independent and provided already with their own house, property, and means of production. On the other hand, where this is not possible, it should be our aim to procure the worker or employee at least the equivalent of such an existence by providing him with a minimum of property and by letting him have a house and garden of his own. If there be such a thing as a social right, this is a right to property, and nothing is more illustrative of the muddle of our time than the circumstance that hitherto no government and no party have inscribed these words on their banner. If they do not think these possess sufficient draw, we believe them to be profoundly mistaken. Is it any wonder then that a couple of years ago Milton Friedman described Röpke as being something of an agrarian? Röpke would likely have agreed that the proper campaign slogan for such an effort would be not a chicken in every pot, but a garden in every plot. Now let me anticipate as I close one possible objection. The foregoing is for some of us easy to dismiss as a romantic indulgence, as an exercise in sloppy sentimentalism, but it is not. It is a hard-headed, concrete proposal that is as useful to the economy as it is satisfying to human nature. That is what makes it finally humane. This is not merely the testimony of one man, but it expresses an enduring vision in Western European thought, Christian and pre-Christian alike. From the Garden of Eden in Holy Scripture, to the literature of Milton's Paradise Lost, to Xenophon's The Economist, who defends the living of the ancient Greek country squire and the virtue taught by living in the country life, to the similar views of the ancient Republic Romans and the early Americans with their image of Cincinnatus, to the actual utility of the garden plots in the Soviet economy and their utility in capitalistic European existence in the 20th century, economic independence and the good life have been identified with this Repke-esque formula. Most recently, it has been reaffirmed by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in his book Rebuilding Russia, where he states, land embodies moral as well as economic values for human beings. And like Repke, he argues for a wide distribution of land ownership, including garden plots for people in the urban areas and rural alike. He says there should be enough land for everybody. So if we want an alternative to the welfare state, to expanding government intrusion in our lives, and still have a stable free market in a society that is also just, we must stop wringing our hands over marginal tax rates, the GDP statistics, the unemployment figures, and merely money income, and find ways to help Americans regain a measure of security and economic independence by making them, once again, as in early America, genuine property owners. Such a restoration will be the first step toward realizing the humane economy. Thank you.